This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And at the end of this Independence Day week, we're going to revisit a conversation on American history, specifically the American presidency and the way the institution of the presidency affected the development of photography. As we'll hear, America itself was also influenced by the way presidents have been photographed. Earlier this year, I spoke with Kara Finnegan, a historian of photography and the author of Photographic Presidents, Making History from Daguerreotype to Digital. She's a professor and associate head of the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Because this part of our show is on tape, we're not taking calls, but you can let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org or by tweeting with us at 21st Show. Okay, here now is my conversation with Kara Finnegan. Kara, thank you so much for being with us on the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Kara, so I want to roughly follow the structure of your book in our conversation today, and that means beginning with the first widely photographed president. I was surprised to read it was George Washington. Wasn't he dead when photography became a thing?
He was very dead, Brian, and he had been dead for many decades before photography was even invented. But I ended up starting the book with Washington because when I started doing the research, I was surprised and then probably ultimately not all that surprised that Washington became photographic even decades after his death.
How did that happen? What form did that take?
When photography first came to the United States, the history of how photography was invented is a complicated one. There's more than one inventor. But for our purposes, for my purposes in the book, I focused on the invention of the daguerreotype, which was really the first photographic technology that came to the United States from France. And it came really as an open source technology in 1839. And so when we think about open source today, we think about how somebody basically gives you all the instructions to build the thing yourself. And that's what happens. So pretty soon after photography gets introduced in France in 1839, things come across the ocean and people start experimenting in the United States. And one of the things that becomes clear very quickly is that photography and those who are practicing it really want legitimacy. And one of the ways to get legitimacy is to either get elite famous people to pose for you so that you can then display their image to show everybody else, look, here's what this important famous person looks like in a photograph. We've never seen them in a photograph before. This is a new medium. But at the same time, it's a way to kind of build authority for the art. So even though Washington is not around, he is metaphorically a really key symbol of the American nation in this period, really for the whole period up until arguably the late 19th century. And so what that means is people began photographing Washington. Now, obviously they're not photographing the person, but what they're doing is they're making daguerreotypes, these early photographs, they're making daguerreotypes of paintings of Washington, of sculptures, busts of Washington, and then they're displaying them as a way to, you know, show off their skill, certainly at being photographers, but they're also doing it to show that photography is important enough in art that, even Washington could and should be photographed.
I gotta say, I was struck in the book by photos of people wanting to pose with these images or busts of George Washington. And it reminds me of something I saw just in the last week or two in the New York Times of a group of Wyoming Republicans at a fundraiser posing with a cardboard cutout of former President Trump. Do you see a connection in what people are doing today and what they were doing then?
That's a really great example. I think there is a connection. And it's this idea of the kind of virtual presence. Right. So you don't have Trump there, but you have his image, and that allows you to show your, you know, fidelity to him or your support for him. And the same thing happened. And what's interesting about these early photographs where a photographer like a guy named Gabriel Harrison, who I talk a little bit about in the book, for example, he poses his own children, his small children. He poses a daughter and then he poses a son with a bust of George Washington placed on a pillar. And I showed this image actually at a talk I gave up at the Art Institute for the Chicago Humanities Festival several years ago. And the minute it clicked onto the screen, everybody burst out laughing because it just seemed kind of ridiculous. You've got these little children literally like hugging and looking up to this bust of Washington. It just seems so kind of hilariously blatantly, you know, nationalistic, the father of the country, all of that. But that was really the purpose. The purpose was to, in this period, was really to associate this new art and the living people who could be photographed by the new art with, you know, the so-called father of the country, this iconic American figure.
Can you talk a little bit in general about the importance of portraiture in early American life?
One of the reasons I think the daguerreotype takes off in the United States the way it does is because it turned out to be a pretty good medium for portraiture. Daguerreotype portraits are very rich, they're very detailed, they're very very accurate, sometimes problematically so if you don't like the way you looked in your daguerreotype. But why people picked up on the daguerreotype as a way to do portraiture is because portraiture itself was a really important American art. The idea behind certainly portraits of presidents and other elite figures during this period was that a portrait wasn't just supposed to be a faithful representation of, you know, what you looked like. It was really supposed to communicate something about your character. And there were a lot of very culturally embedded and deep beliefs about how your face could show your character. These were so embedded that probably people at the time wouldn't have been able to explain them, but they lived them and they felt them and they knew them. And so as a result of that, portraiture is an art form that is respected and also just, it's necessary. It's necessary if you're an American elite, male primarily, we're talking primarily about elite white men in this period. It's necessary for you to, as John Quincy Adams later put it, to communicate your memory to the next age. So a portrait, having a portrait made of yourself, a painted portrait, for example, both signals your own importance, but at the same time, it also signals your value for the future, right? This is something people will look back on and see and understand something about you. And then when photography comes along, it enables that, but it also, the great orator and activist and abolitionist Frederick Douglass highlighted that photography also democratized portraiture so that now anybody with a certain amount of money, and it didn't have to be a lot of money, could go and have their own portrait made. And so he famously said something like, you know, even the lowliest servant girl, you know, in the town could go get her portrait made. And so what's really fascinating about photography as it emerges in this period, its earliest period, is that it's both embraced as another way to communicate, you know, this sort of elite, mostly male character to the people, but it's also taken up by more average people who want to see what they look like, and they want to be able to share images of themselves with one another.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Professor Kara Finnegan of the University of Illinois, whose book is Photographic Presidents, Making History from Daguerreotype to Digital. We're not taking calls for this segment, but you can always join the conversation in real time on Twitter at 21st Show, at 21st Show. We've been talking about the daguerreotype and the change from oil paintings and other art representations of famous people. It's democratized. Anyone can do it. It has this incredible fidelity, and wonder is one of the other words you use to describe it. But you mentioned John Quincy Adams, and he had an ambivalent relationship with daguerreotypes, right?
Yeah, he really did. He was one of my more fun discoveries in the book because Adams was a really faithful keeper of a diary. And I knew that he was an important figure in the history of photography, because actually the oldest existing photograph we have of a president is a daguerreotype of John Quincy Adams. And so I thought, well, I'm going to need to talk about Adams. And then when I dug in, I realized he has this diary where among the many, many other things that he chronicles over these thousands of pages over his whole life, he chronicles going to get photographed. He chronicles his visits to the daguerreotypist, and he tells us what he thinks about this new art of photography. And yeah, he is not a fan, certainly initially. And he tries very hard to get a good picture of himself. And
all hideous, right? That was his first.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He describes one of his early photos as all hideous. What I love about that is it's this moment where, yes, he's this incredibly elite figure. Like, John Quincy Adams was painted by the most famous painters of the day. And he is literally a child of the American Revolution. You know, he is a former president himself. He's a former Secretary of State. He's the son of our second president. So he is about as famous as you can be. And he's very familiar with being visually represented. So when he starts to go to get photographed, he has a lot of what I would describe as pretty educated feedback to provide in his diary about what he thinks. Are photographs good ways to communicate the memory of a person to the next age? Why would anybody want a photograph of themselves? Is it better than other kinds of portraiture? So he's really debating a lot of these questions in the diary, and those debates he's having with himself there are grounded in his experiences. And what's fun about looking at Adams's experiences is that they really echo the experiences of most everyone in this period when photography was in its infancy. Photography was an unreliable chemical art, sometimes depending on many things, including the time of day, the amount of light, the skill of the photographer. Sometimes you could get an image at all, and sometimes you couldn't get anything. And so you have that kind of uncertainty, which Adams didn't like, because, you know, if you're going to communicate your memory to the next age, it should be something pretty permanent. And he did not see photography as a very permanent art. But also, there's literally the problem of your body and your aging body in the case of Adams, because to sit for a daguerreotype that would produce any image at all, much less a really good image, a good portrait of yourself, you had to sit without moving or blinking, importantly, for a certain length of time. And Adams was, when he began to get photographed in the early 1840s, he was near the end of his life. He was an older man. And he talks in the diary about messing up daguerreotypes because he fell asleep or he blinked. He very famously, one of the lines he says is, I dozed and the picture fell asleep. And what he means by that is, you know, I closed my eyes and they were closed long enough that that exposure of the daguerreotype caught that and captured it. And so I had eyes closed in my picture. We've all had that moment, right, where your eyes are closed in the picture. So Adams is really ambivalent about photography, but it also struck me that he kept going back and trying again. He was very kind of dedicated to pursuing this. And, you know, I think the way as I counted it from his references in the diary, he sat for somewhere upwards of like 50 daguerreotypes between 1842 and when he died in 1848. And, you know, you might go for one sitting and they might take five or six of them. So, you know, sometimes these were in batches, but this was someone who was interested in the art, and you could infer from the diary that he knows it's important, but he's just not sure it's for him. And he's just not sure it's the kind of portrait that you would want to have for history.
Too true to the original, he says at one point.
Exactly, exactly.
I am curious. I think a lot of lay readers, as we're moving forward through history beyond John Quincy Adams into the age of Abraham Lincoln, we think of him as one of the earliest widely photographed presidents, but you don't actually spend a lot of time on him in the book. Why not?
Partly that's because I've written a certain amount about Lincoln in the past. But the main reason is that the book really is organized around what I saw as key moments in the technological transformation of photography. So the invention of photography, and then moments later where, for example, the rise of the ability to to have a portable camera where anybody can take a picture and get it developed. And then, you know, later, much more recently for us, the rise of digital photography. I really kind of pegged the book's stories to these moments where presidents are not just engaging with photography, and certainly Lincoln did, but they're engaging with photography at a moment where the medium itself is really changing, transforming, in ways that then the presidents have to deal with.
And so Lincoln is at the end of a trend, or in the middle of one sort of era, maybe, but not necessarily on the cusp of something new.
Yeah, and he serves in, you know, for me in the book, I talk a little bit about one of the most famous images of Lincoln, the so-called Cooper Union photograph. And that photograph, and Lincoln himself is kind of a bridge between this daguerreotype period where you have these early photographs that can't be copied or easily circulated or printed in the newspaper. You know, they're really these unique objects, and that's because of the limitations of the technology at the time. And then with Lincoln, you get the beginning of the ability to print photographs on paper. But if you want to put an image of Lincoln into a magazine, you still need to turn it into an engraving first. So he's in this kind of bridge period. And then what happens beginning in the 1880s is then we begin to develop the technology called halftone, which allows photographs to be printed directly in newspapers and magazines, more like in the way that we would see them today. So Lincoln is kind of riding the end of the initial history, the initial beginning of the history of photography, and then he is at the very, very beginning of a moment where photography is becoming, you know, photographs are something that can be sold and traded and shared on paper, and then later published in the media.
Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, more from my conversation recorded earlier this year with Professor Kara Finnegan of the University of Illinois. Her book is Photographic Presidents: Making History from Daguerreotype to Digital. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and at the end of this Independence Day week, we're revisiting my conversation from earlier this year with Kara Finnegan, a historian of photography and the author of Photographic Presidents: Making History from Daguerreotype to Digital. She's also a professor and associate head of the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. We're not taking calls because this is on tape, but let us know what you thought. Talk@21stshow.org is the email address. Talk@21stshow.org. Let's skip ahead now to President McKinley and the race to find the last photographs of him. What was that about?
William McKinley was president in the very late 19th century. And by that time, photographs could be reproduced in newspapers and magazines. And you had what I would describe today as sort of the beginnings of what we now would today think of as true photojournalism, news photography. McKinley became an important figure for me to write about in the book because his assassination at the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo, New York in 1901 marked this moment where the need to have real-time coverage of what we would call spot news really emerges. And McKinley visits Buffalo to do essentially a very ceremonial presidential thing. He comes to Buffalo with his wife. He gives a big speech. Many crowds gather. He then participates in a number of other sorts of ceremonial activities. For example, he visits Niagara Falls. And then one afternoon, at the exposition, he is scheduled to do a kind of in-person meet and greet at one of the buildings at the exposition. And he is shot by a man named Leon Czolgosz, who came to the exposition with the intent to shoot the president. And McKinley then is taken to the private home where he had been staying. And a bullet was removed from McKinley. Immediately after he was shot, but they couldn't get the second bullet, and so they left it inside of him. And so he's brought home, brought to this private home where he'd been staying, presumably to recover and to be monitored by doctors and nurses. And so that takes a week, and then McKinley ends up dying roughly 7 or 8 days later. So this whole event, right, is a very important national event. It's a very dramatic event. It's the third assassination of a president in something like 36 years. So I think sometimes we forget that the late 19th century was really dominated by these presidential assassinations, Lincoln and then Garfield and then McKinley. So this is a very scary moment. And the news organizations, the national and local newspapers and magazines, feel compelled to photographically cover everything. But what was really fascinating to me was that despite the dramatic presence of cameras all over the exposition, people were encouraged to bring their cameras. You could buy official photos at the exposition. Despite the presence of so many cameras, there was no photograph of the actual shooting. And photographic technology at the time would not have really made that very possible. But there was this idea being communicated in the newspapers and the magazines after the shooting that, well, maybe somebody could have done it because there were so many cameras, right? So how could we not have photographed this incredible event? There are no photographs of the actual shooting. And so what people who were covering the story needed to do instead was they kind of overcompensated by covering literally everything else. They photographed the chair where McKinley sat after he was shot. They photographed the house and the people coming and going from the house where he was recovering. And then later, when he passed away, they began to publish what they started to label as his last photographs. And this was a phrase that really struck out to me, and I started to pay more attention in studying the narrative around this assassination. And it became very clear to me that what was going on was that it was sort of like the media, the journalists and the media, the news photographers, their brains thought that they should be able to cover more visually than they really could do technologically. So they wanted to be able to show photographs of the shooting. They wanted to be able to show the spot news because, you know, we have these cameras, it should be something we can do. But of course, technologically, they couldn't do that yet. And so they overcompensated by essentially trying to pin their photographs and frankly, to sell their photographs as close to the moment of the shooting as they possibly could. So I talk in the book about, you know, some photos were published that were captioned, you know, photograph of President McKinley the day before he was shot, or the last photograph of President McKinley taken just minutes before he was shot. So there was this impulse on the part of the news folks to get as close as they possibly could to the event, because they knew that that's what the public was interested in, is the moment of that shooting. And so what was really fascinating to me about this was the way that the proliferation of all of these photographs that had been made of McKinley before he was shot, the way that proliferation fed into the coverage of him after the assassination. So we make all these photos that are, you know, it's like McKinley's giving a speech, he's shaking hands. These are pretty boring kind of photos of a famous person, you know, visiting the exposition. But after his death, they take on this resonance, right? This memory of, this was the last time that McKinley did this, or this was the last speech he gave. One of the photos was even captioned, McKinley's last trolley ride, which was a picture of McKinley riding a trolley to Niagara Falls. So you really see photography at this moment in terms of its engagement with President McKinley's shooting and death. Photography is trying to figure out what it's good at and what it wants to be good at in the future. And what it wants to be good at is that kind of real-time, you know, almost spot news coverage.
Yeah. And that gets into the idea of the candid camera, which I think we're just going to glance over in our discussion for the sake of time, because you write a bit about Hoover and FDR, Hoover hating the candid camera, FDR at least adapting to it. And you have this line about him sort of skillfully appointing the visual values, the candid camera champions. He famously did not want people to see his leg braces from his polio, but also sort of was able to take on some of the aspects of what candid cameras promised in his presidency. But let's jump ahead to the Obama presidency in the digital era. I think most of our listeners will be aware and have seen some of the photos that you selected for the book. They were the ones that I thought of before I even read those chapters, in terms of Obama in the Situation Room, Obama bending over, letting a young African-American child touch his hair. Can you talk about Obama's innovation? Because presidential photographers have been a thing for a long time. What changed with the Obama presidency?
Rise of digital culture, and then along with that, social media really did change the landscape in a pretty big way in the context of presidential photography. And as you said, you know, presidents have had official photographers for a very long time. And what I started to notice really in my classroom, because when Obama was elected, I was teaching some courses in visual politics and visual communication. And I started to notice, okay, they're doing different things. And one of the things they were doing was they were using this platform, social media photography platform called Flickr, to make photos that they were ostensibly making for history, you know, to go in the Obama library eventually. They were making some of these photos available on Flickr more or less in real time. So you weren't seeing every single one of the thousands and thousands of photographs that the White House shot, but you were seeing a really carefully curated vision of kind of what it was like behind the scenes in the Obama presidency. And that was new and different and interesting. And so what I do in the book is I actually look primarily at this Flickr archive, which was added to over time. It was, you know, essentially built in real time from early 2009 until Obama left office. I think the total number of images that are there is 6,668. And because of the way the Presidential Records Act works, we won't see all of the photos that were made by White House photographer Pete Souza and his staff for a few more years. So this archive that still exists on Flickr is really kind of the most complete visual record we have of what the White House wanted us to see about Obama's presidency. So my question there was really just, what is it that this site is doing? And I talk about it in the book in a few different ways. It was definitely creating a record of Obama's presidency for posterity. And not only in terms of what we might think of as, you know, the political side of things or the policy side of things, but, you know, getting back to that idea we talked about earlier with portraiture, clearly one of their goals was also to communicate visually some ideas about what Obama was like as a person. And presidential photographers have talked about that that is one of their goals, is to show something about, in the case up until now still, to show something about the president as a man, as opposed to the president as a kind of figurehead. And so they did that really well in the Flickr site, and so well that often the images that they circulated got recirculated and appropriated and edited and changed by this kind of wild ride social media culture that we all live in now. So one of the things I got interested in was sort of the White House wanted to control certain things about Obama's visual image, and they used Flickr to do that, and they did it very, very well. But at the same time, because, you know, they're using the advantage of social media and all these digital photography developments to keep control over Obama's image. But at the same time, those very same tools make it hard for you to keep control of your own image, because people can take an image and turn it into a meme or manipulate it in some way. You know, there were all kinds of websites that featured, you know, pictures of Obama with babies, or, you know, sites that would show pictures of Barack and Michelle Obama, you know, being a happy married couple together. And there were all of these kind of themes where people were drawing from these official White House photographs and then really doing their own thing with it. So what struck me about this moment that we're still in, but Obama was really at the beginning of it, and I think did it best, was this dynamic between control and lack of control, right? And that tension that all presidents have had to a certain extent since photography became a more public art, certainly in the 20th century and then on into the 21st century. But the digital age really, really amplifies that. And so Obama was both great at it, but also couldn't always control how it worked.
I'm laughing at the meme image, which I had not seen before your book, of the famous Situation Room image, very serious, watching the raid on bin Laden's compound. But this one has photoshopped, I don't know, 50 extra people in it, from Chewbacca to John Lennon, Big Bird, Bob Ross, Pee Wee Herman. He certainly maintained a narrative around his presidency through this photo stream, but it's also an opportunity for others to try and put their own stamp on it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and Obama took advantage of some of that himself as well. So, you know, he posed for selfies. He, you know, tried to, you know, one of the things the Flickr site also kind of chronicles is the extent to which the social media age just allows for kind of fun and informality. And so you see evidence of that there too, even in their official photos. And to a certain extent, you know, a lot of those kinds of appropriations, like the one you mentioned, there's many, many appropriations of the Situation Room. In fact, that photo has its own Wikipedia page, which if you go to it, you can not only learn about the photo and the actual historical circumstances, but you can also get linked to all the memes and stories about it. But that photo is an example of, you know, to a certain extent, the Obama administration also benefited, right, from these appropriations, because it kept him in the news. And even after he left office and President Trump took office, Obama's White House photographer, Pete Souza, you know, now working as a private citizen, began to recirculate his photos that he had made of Obama on his own Instagram account, on Souza's own Instagram account, in ways that directly were essentially trolling Donald Trump. So even when Obama wasn't in office anymore, this visual archive that they had created during his presidency was still out there circulating.
And he even made a book of that. Kara Finnegan, your book is called Photographic Presidents: Making History from Daguerreotype to Digital. Thank you so much for being with us on the 21st.
You're welcome.
And that's all the time we have for our program today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again on Monday.